Hello, and welcome to the Scriptures Are Real podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about elements of the Scriptures that help them become more real to us so we can draw more power out of them, because we need all the help we can get. I'm your host, Kerry Muehlstein, and I'm so glad to have with me today Dr. Matthew Godfrey, a returning guest. Thanks for being with us, Matt.
Thanks, Kerry. I'm super excited to be here. Always enjoy being with you and talking about the Scriptures with you.
Well, it makes me happy, and you've blessed us so much. I'll remind our listeners that Dr. Godfrey was with us before when we did sections earlier. We talked about several sections, including a little bit, one of the sections in today's or this week's reading. We talked about the United Firm and the Literary Firm. That was episode 34. So you can both learn more about Dr. Godfrey then, and because section 104 touches on that, and we talked about it in that episode, I highly recommend that episode to you. You can go back and kind of catch up on what was going on there. We probably won't talk about it here, but let me just tell everyone a little bit about you, Matt, if that's okay.
Sure.
Dr. Godfrey works for the church's church history department, and he's been part of the Joseph Smith Papers and so on, but is also part of their public outreach efforts. I suppose we may be part of that. Well, thank you for reaching out to us. And is just a great scholar and a great member of the church, a great guy. What else should we know about you, Matt?
Oh, man, I'm happy today to be talking about Zion's Camp Revelations because I love Zion's Camp. One of my assignments on the Joseph Smith Papers was to be one of the historians on Documents Volume 4, which covers the Zion's Camp expedition. And so stemming from my research on that, I've published a couple of articles on Zion's Camp. It's just something that fascinates me, that I think is such a wonderful and sometimes misunderstood event in church history. So I'm really happy to be here to talk about that.
Well, we are glad to have you. And I mean, he is so much the guy that I think you're on like every podcast this week to talk about it. But I each have our different way of doing it. And we here, we won't try and cover everything in this reading assignment. We'll have the ability to, I mean, we'll give some overview, I'm sure, but we'll have the ability to just kind of deep dive on whatever we want to. So I'm excited to see where the conversation goes. Why don't you take us there, Matt?
All right. Well, I think, you know, a couple things that I'd like to focus on is just for one, some of the scriptures that pertain to Zion's Camp. So sections 103 and 105 are the two revelations in this week's reading that pertain to Zion's Camp. Section 103 is one that was revealed to Joseph Smith in February of 1834. And it came the same day that Lyman Wyatt and Parley P. Pratt had arrived in Kirtland, Ohio from Missouri. And so, as I'm sure you've talked about on other episodes of the podcast, the Saints are expelled from Jackson County, Missouri in the first week of November, 1833. Most of them go across the river into Clay County. And because it's winter, they're suffering. They've lost everything that they had in Jackson County. And so they sent Lyman White and Parley P. Pratt to Kirtland to kind of inform Joseph Smith about what was going on in Missouri. And when they get there, they meet with the Kirtland High Council, which has just been set up just 2 weeks before. And actually, that's what Section 102 covers in this week's reading, is the establishment of the Kirtland High Council.
Yeah, and I'll cover that in my Patreon website, the little bonus material that we do there.
Yeah. So they meet with the Kirtland High Council, Joseph Smith's in attendance at that meeting. And we don't know whether Section 103 came before that meeting, after the meeting, or in the meeting itself. But sometime on that same day, Joseph receives Section 103, which is the revelation that directs him to go and recruit people to come to the aid of the saints in Missouri. And so it's an important revelation for that reason. If you remember in section 101, the Lord gave the parable of the nobleman whose land had been overrun by his enemies and who directed his servant to call up the strength of his house to go and reclaim his land. Section 103, the Lord says in that revelation, Joseph, you're the servant in this parable. You need to go call up the strength of my house and go and reclaim the land in Jackson County. And so Section 103 is really kind of what sets Zion's camp in motion. There are several people in that section that are directed to go out and recruit men and money for the expedition. And so those efforts occur over the next couple of months. The expedition itself departs in May of 1834. There's one contingent that leaves from Kirtland, Ohio. There's another contingent that leaves from Michigan Territory. And they kind of both make their way into Missouri. They'll meet in June on the Salt River in Missouri and kind of join forces there. And so it's this march of about 230 men, women, and children from these locations to the Saints in Clay County. It occurs in May and June of 1834. Towards the end of June 1834, June 22nd, Joseph receives Section 105, which is the revelation that ends the Zion's Camp expedition. In that revelation, the Lord tells Joseph that it is no longer required of him and the saints to redeem Zion at that time, that they need to wait for a season to be able to do that. And so the expedition disbands at that time. There's a cholera epidemic that breaks out around the same period of time that ends up killing 13 members of Zion's camp and two other church members in Clay County. There are some members of Zion's camp that stay in Missouri at that time. Others travel back to Ohio and make their way back there. And so that's just kind of a little overview of the expedition itself and kind of how those two revelations, 103 and 105, fit in there.
Very helpful. Thank you. Yeah. And I mean, the last few weeks we've been covering this Missouri material. So hopefully our audience has that good build up to what got us to this point, you know, and the terrible things that happened in July of 1833 and so on. But that's a great overview. Thank you for that.
One of the things that I think is interesting in Section 103, and it kind of extends back into Section 101, and it kind of gets at, I think, what I talked about before, that sometimes Zion's camp can be a little bit misunderstood. And so if I could share that verse in Section 103, if that's all right. So Section 103, sorry, I should have had this brought up before. Let me get there quickly.
No worries.
So the Lord tells Joseph in this section in verse 15, he says, "Behold, I say unto you, the redemption of Zion must needs come by power."
Yeah.
And I think we read that verse and then we read that parable of the nobleman that's given in Section 101, where the servant calls up the strength of the Lord's house and they march over and reclaim the land. And I think we have this idea in our minds that that must mean that what the Lord was telling Joseph to do was to, you know, raise an army, go into Missouri, march into Jackson County and forcibly take the lands back that the Jackson County citizens had taken from the saints. And I think oftentimes that's kind of what we have in our minds as to what the purpose of Zion's camp was. But one of the interesting things about this is when you look at the documents that surround Zion's camp, you realize that the expedition wasn't ever really set up as an army that would go on the offensive and go and reclaim land from, you know, the people in Jackson County. There's a letter that Oliver Cowdery and Sidney Rigdon write it's kind of like a circular letter that's sent out to various branches of the church that talk about the Zion's Camp expedition. And it kind of outlines the purpose of the expedition. And it has its roots in some communications that Joseph Smith and other church leaders had with Governor Daniel Dunklin and members of his cabinet in 1833 after the saints had been expelled from Jackson County. And so there have been some communications and in some letters that were received from some Missouri officials, it kind of intimated that Governor Dunklin of Missouri would be willing to call up the state militia to escort the Saints back to their lands in Jackson County.
And Joseph seems to have kind of been counting on that, right?
Yeah. And so that's exactly kind of why Zion's Camp came about. They believed that Governor Dunklin would be willing to do this. And so their belief was, well, he can call up the state militia to escort church members back to their lands, but then he can't just have the state militia mustered indefinitely to protect the Saints. And so there would need to be a force that would protect the Saints from being expelled from their lands again in Jackson County. And that's really what Zion's Camp was meant to be. It was meant to be that protection, that protectionary force that after the state militia had restored the Saints to their land, they would protect the Saints from being driven off the land again. And so that's really what the purpose behind Zion's Camp was. It wasn't that we were going to go march into Jackson County and we're going to take the land ourselves. It was more, we're going to go into Missouri. We're going to ask Governor Dunklin to call up the state militia. The militia will escort the Saints back to their lands. And then once it's disbanded, then the members of Zion's Camp would stay there and protect the Saints from being expelled again. So I think that's an interesting thing.
It's very interesting, and that it's part of why, at least my understanding of it, is as they're going along, they learn that Governor Dunklin's not going to send the militia. This is part of some of the even misunderstandings in the camp, that there are some people who feel like, well, then what did we come here for, and so on. And then maybe that's the real tricky question. But it's part of why they will end up disbanding.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Once they get into Missouri, they send Parley P. Pratt and Orson Hyde to Governor Dunklin, and they talk to the governor and make the request that he call up the state militia. And Governor Dunklin tells them, apparently, that he's not willing to call up the state militia at that time. And, you know, sometimes we'll see that and we'll be like, oh, it's because, you know, he didn't like the Latter-day Saints, and so he wasn't willing to do anything for them. There probably is some truth to that. I think there is evidence in other communications that Dunklin had that he did not like the Latter-day Saints. He, you know, didn't think that it was a legitimate church. But at the same time, there were also some negotiations going on at the same time between people in Jackson County and church leaders in Clay County. And so part of me wonders if maybe Governor Dunklin was just wanting to see how those negotiations would play out before he did anything like call up the state militia. But you're right, Kerry, once they find this out and they see that Governor Dunklin's not willing to call up the state militia, that kind of puts a huge wrench in their plans, because if he's not going to call up the militia to escort the Saints back, and if the Saints themselves have to go into Jackson County to try to reclaim their land, Joseph Smith realizes, and he's told by many people, that if the Saints march into Jackson County without that militia, they're going to get attacked. There's going to be a lot of bloodshed and a lot of fighting that occurs at that time.
And what's more, having corresponded with the governor, not getting his help, and then going ahead on their own, they kind of become a rogue group and run the risk of bringing the state militia in against themselves and so on, right? Because they came with one understanding. Then if they do something different, they've basically become their own vigilante mob. Now, I mean, they've been kicked out by vigilante mobs, right? But that's when they are trying to work with government and then work on their own instead, that puts you in a very different territory.
Yeah. And in fact, there's some citizens from Lafayette County in Missouri that actually send Joseph Smith a communication that says, we object to these foreign Mormons coming here and, you know, as kind of an armed force.
Right.
And so, you know, when they say foreign Mormons, they mean these people that aren't citizens of the state of Missouri. You know, they're people from outside of Missouri that are coming in here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think if that were to happen today, that people would be concerned. If there were some armed group that came from somewhere else, people would be concerned, right?
Yeah, yeah, so, definitely. You know, and sometimes people say, well, you know, if that's the case, if they weren't going to go and reclaim the land, then how come they had all these weapons with them? And why did they do all this military training as they're marching? And those are fair questions. I think from communications that we have from Joseph Smith, it seems like he believed that because they were, you know, outside of Missouri, they were marching into the state, he believed they were going to be attacked at some point along the journey. And so I think Joseph felt like this group needed to have weapons to protect themselves in case of an attack. But there's two or three, different letters that he writes to different people where he says, we are not going to go on the offensive. We only have weapons for defensive purposes. Yeah. And so I think that's important to consider, too.
Both to defend themselves and, as you said, once the militia is left and what they think is going to happen, to defend all of the saints, right? That's exactly right. Be defensive. And they were nearly attacked, weren't they, on their way?
Yeah, there are several different occasions where they believed, you know, that there were groups who were going to come and attack them. I think the most well-known one of these happens on Fishing River in Missouri, where there's five men that ride into their camp and they tell Joseph Smith that there's a group of about 400 men just across Fishing River and that they're going to march into the camp. And these men say that Zion's camp will see hell before morning. You know, essentially, we're going to wipe you out.
Yeah.
And then after they say this and they leave the camp, Heber C. Kimball says that almost immediately after they leave the camp, you know, they looked up in the sky and they could see like this little black cloud forming. And it just got bigger and bigger and bigger until there was just this gigantic thunderstorm that hit the area, hail, lightning, thunder, heavy rainfall. And because of the storm, the members of Zion's camp believed that this mob that was going to come in and attack them couldn't cross Fishing River. Heber C. Kimball says that the river rose from just a few inches to like 40 feet in just a matter of minutes, which may be a little bit of an exaggeration. Even with that horrific flooding that we had in Texas several weeks ago, I think I was reading something about the river saying that it rose to about 26 feet within an hour. And so I think having a river rise up to 40 feet, that may have been a bit of an exaggeration on Heber C. Kimball's part, but whatever the case, the river rose enough that it wasn't safe for this group to cross the river. And so Zion's camp was protected at that time.
Yeah. And I've been in that area when suddenly tornado form and rains, just torrential rains come. And we ended up being up near, at Hans Mill the next day. And you could see that still that river was much higher than it had been just before. So it can happen very quickly. I've seen a little bit of it myself, but had to hunker down in the visitor center as the tornado went past. But anyway, that is a real thing. And you don't want to try and cross a river in those kinds of conditions.
Yeah, for sure.
So the fear that they might be attacked was realistic, even if they didn't end up being attacked. And that seems to me to be a miraculous way to avoid that attack. But one way or the other, it's a very realistic fear. They're getting threats. There are people who are concerned about them coming through. And then, as you said, they were ready to be defensive in the settlement area as well. So if it's all right, and I know you have some things you want to jump into, and maybe this is one of them, but for me, one of the questions that people usually have is, okay, so if God knows everything and he knows that the militia wasn't going to come, why in the world do this? Why have a revelation? Because this is what we've got. We've got section 103 right here. Why have a 103 if God knows 105 is going to come? I don't know if you have any thoughts on that or what. We can talk about something else first if you'd like, or whatever you would like.
No, I think that's great. I think it's an important question, and I think it kind of gets at expectations that we might have about things that the Lord has told us. And sometimes if our expectations are different from the outcome, then it can make us think, well, you know, maybe this wasn't really from the Lord. Maybe the Lord didn't really tell us that, or maybe I didn't get inspiration from the Lord to do something because it didn't turn out the way that I thought that it should.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes it's a little dangerous to try to figure out the Lord's motivations behind why he tells us to do certain things, because we have limited understanding. We don't always know the purpose of this. And I think for me, a good example of this comes with my patriarchal blessing and my mission. So I was told in my patriarchal blessing, and talking about my mission, it says very specifically in that it promises me success on my mission. And I got called to the Belgium Antwerp mission, which is the Dutch speaking part of Belgium, went over there, served for 2 years, worked as hard as I could, to try to, you know, help people, make covenants, had very few people that wanted to listen to me that would go through lessons. Eventually I think there was one man who I helped teach for a few weeks that was baptized, but he was the only person that I ever taught that ended up getting baptized. And so for me, after my mission, I looked at that promise in my patriarchal blessing and I thought, you know, why is this promising me success? Was the patriarch just wrong about this? Did, you know, was he thinking he was getting inspiration about this and he really wasn't? Because I sure didn't feel successful on my mission.
Right.
And it took me a lot of time and a lot of thinking and a lot of talking with people about this to kind of realize that my gauge for success on my mission completely hinged on how many people I baptized or how many people I taught were baptized. And I thought that was the only way to gauge success. But maybe when the Lord, through the patriarch, promised me success on my mission, maybe that's not what he had in mind. Maybe he had other things in mind. And so I think, you know, kind of relating this to Zion's camp, it seems like when you read section 103 that the Lord was saying, if you get enough people and you go into Missouri, you're going to be able to get the land back. You'll be able to redeem Zion. And then they get there and the Lord says, well, you actually, you know, it's not time yet to redeem Zion. But the Lord gives some very specific reasons in there why it was not time yet to redeem Zion. One of which was essentially that the church as a whole had not sufficiently supported the Zion's camp expedition.
Yeah, they had far fewer than the Lord had asked.
Exactly, yeah. You know, the Lord says in section 103, I want you to have 500 people that go. And then he basically says, but if you can't get that, get 400, get 300, get 200, and don't go if you can't get at least 100 people. And when that first contingent leaves Kirtland in May of 1834, there's 120 people in that contingent. Now, the ranks grow over time because Parley P. Pratt and others are out recruiting at the same time that people are marching until you get to about 230. But even at 230, that's not even half what the Lord really asked for.
Yeah.
And so the Lord tells them in section 105, those first verses in there, he says, you know, the people in the churches abroad, which means branches of the church outside of Missouri and outside of Kirtland, didn't sufficiently support the expedition, both with recruits for the expedition or with money to support it. And so that was one reason why Zion wasn't redeemed. But at the same time, and kind of going back to what I was saying, that sometimes we have in our minds what success should look like or what the outcome of something should be. There was a lot of good that came from Zion's camp. Even if they didn't get the land back in Jackson County, you know, we talk often when we talk about Zion's camp, and I think it's a really important point that when the original 12 apostles are called in February of 1835, after this expedition occurs, 8 out of the 12 apostles were members of Zion's camp. And just a couple weeks after that, Joseph calls the first 56 men to be members of the 70. And of those 56 men, every single one of them went on the Zion's Camp expedition. And so the expedition, I think, became a way for Joseph Smith to kind of meet people, to associate with them, to see how they reacted in difficult circumstances, to get to know people better, so that when the Lord directed him to call the 12 apostles and to call the 70, he had information that he would need in order to make those callings. You know, it's kind of like when President Nelson talked about calling the first presidency after he became president of the church. And he talked about how he talked with each one of the apostles about who they thought should be in there. He gathered information before the revelation came. And I think that was an important part of Zion's Camp. But then the other thing that I think was really important, if you look at reminiscences of people who went on Zion's Camp, who wrote about their experiences there, the vast majority of them saw this as one of the seminal spiritual experiences of their lives. They didn't focus on, well, we didn't achieve the goal of getting the land back. They said this was an expedition where, one, I was able to gain a greater testimony of Joseph Smith and of his leadership. And two, I was able to gain a greater testimony that God was with us, that he was there, that he cared about us, and that he intervened with the expedition miraculously in several different cases. And so I think for each individual member, or for most of them, not all of them, but for most of them, this really was kind of a transformative experience and one that solidified them in the gospel and solidified their testimony of the gospel and helped them see what they were willing to sacrifice for their fellow church members and for the sake of the gospel as well.
Oh, wonderful. And solidified some leadership experience for them. I know we talk about this often, but you know, Brigham Young sees how Joseph leads in something like this. It won't be that long before he is leading saints from Missouri to Quincy, and then not that much longer before he's leading saints from Illinois to Salt Lake. But he has worked with the prophet at that point and has learned invaluable lessons.
Yeah, and kind of to that point, it's interesting to me that when you look at the expedition that Brigham leads from Illinois to the Great Basin, it's organized the same way that Zion's Camp was organized.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, Zion's Camp was originally called the Camp of Israel when it occurred. And that's the same name that Brigham gives to the group leaving Illinois and going to the Great Basin. He calls them the Camp of Israel as well. And so, yeah, just exactly to your point, I think Brigham learned a lot about how to organize people and how to organize a mass movement of people from observing what Joseph did on the Zion's Camp expedition.
Yeah. Yeah. It's important, I think. And maybe we can speak for just a moment. Well, you already have been. Maybe I could also speak to this notion that sometimes we expect one thing and the Lord has different things in mind, even though he sometimes has to tell us, go do this, because it's in the attempting to do that that something else happens. And you've said that so well. And maybe even just on your story, I love, as you said, there are different definitions of success. I very recently, as we had a missionary from our ward who was going out to preach in a country in Europe where probably she won't see that many baptisms. And as her bishop, I just suddenly, I felt very inspired, kind of out of the blue, to say to her, the way to measure the success of your mission is not baptisms, but the amount that you follow the Lord's will. And in reality, I think that's probably the way we measure the success of anything, is the degree to which we learn to follow God's will, whatever twists and turns that takes. That's in many ways really the success of anything we do. But it kind of reminds me of two things in my life that I can maybe share that will help illustrate that story, because I think it's really important that we come to recognize how much the process is important. So one is not a very significant event, but it was very recently as I was going through Missouri with some people, teaching them about Missouri and the church's history there. And as we were driving, and you can end up with some long drives there, and had a little bit of time to think, and was asking myself this same question. I knew God wanted them to go to Missouri. He wanted them to go to Jackson County. He wanted them to try and build these things. He wanted Zion's Camp to come down there. And yet none of it would work out the way they thought it would. And God knew from the beginning that it wouldn't work out that way. Now, to some degree, He's giving them the chance to exercise their agency. No one wants God to not give us the chance to try something because He knows we're not going to do it or not going to make it. Nobody wants that in their life. So he's certainly, you know, giving them the ideal and the commandments and letting them exercise their agency, whether they will do this valiantly or not, you know, whether they'll get enough people to go on the camp or not, and so on. But it also suddenly occurred to me how important it was that they have this process. The things they went through in Missouri, in each phase, and every phase of Missouri has some wonderful things, but also a lot of really hard things in every phase of the church's history in Missouri in those days. And yet, it makes them into a kind of people they need to be. And as I had that thought, it was at the same day I'd been thinking about some of the things that some of my children have been wanting or have been going through and praying, and the Lord, you know, getting blessings from the Lord, all sorts of things. And sometimes it hinges on other people's agency, and sometimes things just aren't working out. And I suddenly realized that that's often what is going on. And I kind of knew what was going on in my life, but I could see in the lives of loved ones that sometimes it's the process as much as the end result. And the end result may be what we think it will be, and it may not be, but the process is incredibly important. And I know I'm talking a lot, but maybe that can allow me to share one other story that's important for me in my life where that happened. And that is when I was pretty fresh home from my mission. Well, actually, this inspiration came while I was on my mission. I really felt like I should teach seminary. And that when I got home, I should pursue the course of teaching seminary. And so I did pursue that course. And I took all the classes you need to take, and I tried all sorts of different things. And I'll just say I saw divine intervention in my life that wasn't what I wanted or expected, that made it so I wasn't going to be a seminary teacher. At the time, that was really confusing to me. I thought, you inspired me to pursue this path, and now you just changed some things so that this isn't happening. What is going on? But it was during that same time period that, because I was pursuing teaching seminary, that I started studying Hebrew and some other things, that I realized how much I loved scholarship as well. And that as a result of all that happening together, I realized that I wanted to be a teacher, but I also wanted to do research. And that steered me into the career path that I have now. And for some people, only scholarship is just right. And for some people, only teaching is right. Well, no one does only teaching. No one does only scholarship. But more emphasis on teaching, more emphasis on scholarship. And I've got a pretty even emphasis in my particular career. And I think that's what God wanted me to do. But I would not be as good a teacher if I hadn't spent all that time working on being a seminary teacher. And I don't think I would have gotten into the scholarship path. And it really just didn't turn out. I'm 100% sure I got inspiration that said, be a seminary teacher. And that's not what God really had in mind for me, but it's the process I needed to go through to get me where He wanted me to be. And sometimes we just have to have faith in that process. I never was a seminary teacher. I taught early morning seminary for a year in California, but I never was a seminary teacher, and I don't anticipate that I'm ever going to be a seminary teacher. But that doesn't mean that that wasn't an inspiration from God. That just means God puts us where we need to be to have the experiences and the process, or the way President Oaks would put it, is the experience of becoming that we need. It seems to me that's part of what's happening here in Missouri, and something that we all need to apply to our lives. So I went on for a long time, didn't give you a chance to talk there, but I don't know if you have more thoughts on that or something else you'd like to talk about.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. Those experiences are invaluable. And it really is, at least for me, I've seen it's in the struggle, it's in the process that I grow the most spiritually.
Yeah.
And so maybe, you know, there are things in my life that I felt inspired to do. Maybe they haven't worked out. But like you said, it's through the process, through going through those experiences, that I learn other things that I need to learn. And so, yeah, I think it's just a great way of saying, you know, if you feel like you've been inspired to do something, you do something and it doesn't work out, it doesn't mean you weren't inspired. It doesn't mean the Lord wasn't directing you. Yeah. You know, it just
it
means
doesn't mean the Lord was wrong.
Yeah, it doesn't mean the Lord was wrong. It just means you needed to take this journey for whatever reason. And you may not understand what that reason is for, you know, years. But at some point, you will understand it and you'll see, oh, OK, I kind of see what the Lord was doing there, even if I didn't at the time.
And, you know, I also kind of saw, as you were talking about, the Lord says, okay, get 500 men. Well, if you can't get this many men, And then when he sends them home, he says, well, you didn't do things exactly the way I was asking. You didn't support this, I guess we should say, exactly the way I was asking. It almost, I was hearing echoes of Oliver Cowdery in the translation of the Book of Mormon. And this idea, Oliver Cowdery really wants to, and God's like, well, okay, you know, and then Oliver kind of doesn't quite go about it. I mean, he has good intents. I don't want to impute any ill intents to Oliver. I think it's just some inexperience and I don't know what all, but he doesn't quite go about it the right way. And God says, well, now the time has passed. You asked, this is not going to happen. Now we have to do things a different way because we're in a different situation now because of things he'd done probably with good intent, but just not exactly right. And I think that kind of thing was happening with the folks on Zion's camp or the camp of Israel, and it happens for all of us as well. And it's not to our condemnation. God did not condemn Oliver for that. He just said, well, you know, you'll get another chance another time for something. So,
yeah, that's great.
And if it's all right, I wanted to bring up just one verse in section 103 that I think speaks to some of what we're talking about. And I don't know, I'd love your input on this. So we're in section 103, verse 20. And there God says, but I say unto you, mine angel shall go up before you, and also my presence. And in time you shall possess the goodly land. Well, we've just talked about how several of those brethren would testify that there were miracles that delivered them. I think there's good evidence that in one way or another, angels went before them, and that those who, there was some contention in the camp, and that always drives away the spirit, right? But there were many who had experiences where they in one way or another did experience God's presence. Yeah. They didn't possess the land at that point. He does say in time, you shall possess the land. And I don't know what that means. I mean, we've got the growth of the church in Missouri right now is insane, but I don't know if that's the fulfillment of that, if there's something else, or I don't know what that means. But there's certainly the part of this verse that hasn't yet been fulfilled, and I don't know, maybe it is fulfilled in some of what's happening there now, but my guess is there's more to be fulfilled. But the first part of that verse, I think, absolutely happened, and the second part does say in time. And I think that word could probably be inserted into many of the inspirations I get. In time, this will happen. Start. So I don't know if you have thoughts along those lines.
Yeah, and it can be hard, too, sometimes because, you know, time isn't the same to the Lord as it is to us. Yeah. And so, you know, we can say, well, yeah, he says in time there, and here we are, we're, what, about 191 years removed from this or something, and they, you know, it's not like we're building the city of Zion in Jackson County right now, necessarily. But 191 years to the Lord is not that long of a period of time.
Well, they keep saying he's coming quickly, so he's got a different definition of quickly than I do.
Exactly, yeah.
Which my kids also have a different definition of than when we need to leave quickly, they have a different definition. So yeah, I get that.
Yeah. And so I think that's one of the hardest things for me, though. I feel like I'm a very impatient person, and I feel like if the Lord You know, if I feel inspiration about something, it should just happen, you know, right then. And if it's been years since I've had that inspiration and it hasn't happened, sometimes I might lose some faith in it or some hope in it and say, well, I guess it's not going to happen because it hasn't happened yet. But if 191 years isn't that much to the Lord, then 8 years or 10 years really isn't that much to the Lord. And so I think we just have to, with some of these promised blessings, you know, we have to be patient. We have to understand that it's in the Lord's timeline and just continue to have faith that he loves us and that things will work out for the best in the end, even if we can't see it right then. And for me, that's not an easy thing to do, like, because I am impatient, but it's crucial, I think, that we wait on the Lord, and then eventually we will see those promises fulfilled.
Yeah, very good. And sometimes we are so impatient, right? Maybe I'll share another story that just happened a couple days ago, that I live about a mile from the erected but not yet finished, I guess, Linden Temple. We've been anxiously thinking. We thought that that the open house would be happening about now, and the dedication would be happening soon, and it's not happening. We just got word that it's not going to happen for a while. And I emailed our stake president when we got that word, and I said, "Would you please tell people in Salt Lake that we are very impatient to have this temple finished so that we can go through it and learn Christ-like attributes, like patience." So, all right. I mean, there's a certain irony in my feeling impatient about it, and I do feel impatient about it, but there's a certain irony in there, right? And I wonder how often we are impatient for God to do things when really the whole point is to learn to trust in God and his timing instead of our own.
Yeah. Well, that's a great example too, because I live in Layton, and we had something similar happen with the Layton Temple, where I think it was 6 years from the groundbreaking until, you know, they finally had the open house and the dedication. And for the last 2 years, it looked to us like the temple was finished. And so we kept thinking, why aren't they dedicating it? Why isn't there an open house? But eventually it happened. So yeah. You know, with Lyndon, it'll eventually happen.
That's so. Exactly right. So yeah. We'll just keep driving past and enjoying the beautiful landmark. So
yep.
Anyway, well, wonderful. Are there other things in these revelations that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, I think there's also a verse in section 105 that I think is important. And that sometimes we might kind of overlook or not quite understand what the Lord is talking about here. So when he tells them in section 105 that it's no longer required of them to redeem Zion at that time, he says, you know, he gives the reasons that the church hasn't been supportive enough of it. He also says that the elders of the church need to.
So sorry, which verse were you in again? Somehow I missed it. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. So this is section 105 and starting with verse 10.
10. Okay, here. Thank you.
So he says that the elders need to be prepared. They need to be able to teach more perfectly and have more experience, know more perfectly concerning their duty, the things which are required at their hands. Verse 11, he says, this cannot be brought to pass until mine elders are endowed with power from on high. And then verse 12, for behold, I have prepared a great endowment and blessing to be poured out upon them, inasmuch as they are faithful and continue in humility before me. So again, you know, you might ask yourself when you read these verses, well, if the Lord knew that these elders needed more preparation and that they needed to wait until the Kirtland Temple was finished and be able to experience the spiritual outpouring there, then why did he have them go on this expedition to begin with? I think some of it has to do with the agency that you were talking about before, because I think what you see on the Zion's Camp expedition, even though most of the people participating in the expedition, you know, behaved well and took the poor conditions in stride, there were certain elements of that expedition that did not. There were people who complained a lot. There were people who contended with other members of the camp, that argued with other members of the camp. There's one occasion when Parley P. Pratt didn't have enough to eat one night, and he went to Sylvester Smith and asked if Sylvester would share some of his food with him. And Sylvester said, "No, I'm not sharing my food." And so there are things that happen during the expedition that I think indicate that perhaps these men who had been, you know, who had volunteered to go, even though their hearts were in the right place, they wanted to do this, they wanted to help the saints, they just still needed some seasoning, needed some more experience, needed to become more unified before they could really see blessings. And maybe those people needed to recognize that and needed to understand that more for themselves. And maybe they wouldn't have recognized that had they not gone on the expedition. But for whatever reason, the Lord says that, you know, the elders needed to wait until they were endowed with power from on high. And then, like I said, in verse 12, he says, "I have prepared a great endowment and blessing to be poured out upon them." So the endowment of power from on high will come in the Kirtland Temple. And as I'm sure you'll talk about, it's not the endowment as we understand it today. That right. endowment doesn't come until Nauvoo. But the spiritual outpouring that happens at the dedication of the Kirtland Temple, at a couple of meetings that occur around that dedication, that's really what the saints at the time believed to be this endowment of power.
Yeah, well, it is an endowment of power. We then apply that phrase to a specific thing after that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we know that that endowment that he's speaking of in verse 12, you know, will come with the Kirtland Temple. But what's the blessing that he has to be poured out upon them? And I think this is an interesting part of kind of church history here, because beginning from this time and over the course of the next couple of years, blessings become really important in the church to a degree that they perhaps had not been before. So this revelation is given June of 1834. December of 1834, Joseph Smith Sr. is called and appointed to be the patriarch to the church. And so he begins to offer blessings to church members, you know, these first patriarchal blessings after this time. People that go on the Zion's Camp expedition, Joseph Smith provides blessings to them periodically, things that are known as Zion's blessings. As I mentioned before, the Quorum of the 12 and the 70 are called in February of 1835. Each person called to one of those callings is given an ordination blessing where they're promised great things. They hold blessing meetings at times in Kirtland where they come and they partake of food, and then Joseph Smith Sr. or others provide blessings to the people there. And so when the Lord is talking about the blessing that he has prepared for them, I think what that refers to is all of these blessings that begin to be given to people after this time in preparation for the dedication of the Kirtland Temple. And so it's not just the endowment that comes around the dedication of the temple. It's also these blessings that are being provided for the saints that reveal God's will to them. They reveal God's love to them. They help them to see how they've been able to be living the gospel themselves. I think all of these are kind of wound up in the blessing that the Lord says he has prepared for them in that verse.
That's beautiful. And I think we may underestimate how much the things going on or not going on with the temple have to do with a lot of things happening in Missouri, because the saints in Missouri, and we've talked about this a little bit at this point already, but the saints in Missouri were commanded to build a temple. That's where the first temple was supposed to be. And they are expelled from Jackson County without having really started it at all. They've dedicated the land right when they first got there, within the first couple days of Joseph getting there, right? But they never make that progress or any progress in building the temple. And so eventually the Lord says, all right, well then do it in Ohio. And a little bit later, he gets after them again. And we've already talked about that. But I think the fact that no temple is being built delays a number of things for them. And it's another example of this. I had things for you, but you didn't demonstrate that you were quite ready for it. And I know that's the case for us in all sorts of things, whether it be more revelation, you know, the sealed portion of the Book of Mormon or other revelations or whatever else. And I know in my own life, I'm sure God has things that he would be willing to give me if I would just prepare myself for them and be more diligent in the things he's already given me. And I think that's another really important lesson to learn here.
Yeah. You know, that just reminds me too, again, of how much during President Nelson's presidency, he's talked about preparation and about the need to be prepared for Christ's second coming and the need to really start to understand how to receive revelation and how important that is. And he's really emphasized preparation so much during his presidency. It makes me think I probably need to do a better job of, you know, feeling prepared for the second coming. And even if it doesn't happen during my lifetime, you know, just being able to be prepared for it, I think is a good place to be if you are prepared.
Yeah, we've had a number of what's not really shocking, but in some ways feels to be shocking statements, like you said, where President Nelson says, "I don't know when the second coming is, but I do know we are supposed to be preparing for it." Or Christofferson has talked about it's not for lack of wickedness in the world that Christ isn't coming again. It's that we aren't prepared. We need to have a greater critical mass of covenant keepers and so on and so on. Right. So there is really something to that preparation. Thank you for that. Well, I'd like to ask you a question, and I'm totally sandbagging you here. I hadn't thought of asking this question, so I didn't prep you for it. So we can cut this out if it ends up that it's not a question that you want to discuss. But there's a story that's kind of near and dear to our family that I think is a true story. So that's what I'm hoping you can confirm or deny such stories. And that is that when they have cholera, and we know both Joseph and Hiram get very, very ill. If I remember right, Joseph vomits so violently, he dislocates his jaw and so on. But they get very, very ill. And the story that I think is correct is that at one point, their mother, Lucy Mack Smith, is praying for them. And Hiram says that he sees that she's been praying under an apple tree. And he tells Joseph, "We're going to be all right. I've seen that mother is praying for me." And they get home and learn that she actually had been praying under an apple tree for them. Is that story accurate?
Yeah, so that story comes from Lucy herself.
Yeah.
It's in her history.
She talks about that
moment where she felt like she needed to pray for them. And that she learns later that at the time she was praying for them, Joseph and Hiram were both sick. And again, you know, according to Lucy, she says Hiram did say to Joseph, you know, "Everything will be all right, because I see that mother is praying for us at this time." So that is a story that comes from Lucy. So I would be inclined to believe it because of that.
Yeah, I mean, she is an eyewitness to at least part of that. She was doing it herself. And that means, I mean, we have a son who is in Honduras, which is it's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And he's serving there. He's been there for a couple of weeks. And so praying for him has been a real and a powerful thing for us and our family. He's doing great. He loves it. He's having great experiences, but also some crazy experiences. And so, but he's loving it. But that kind of thing means a lot to us. And as I think about Zion's Camp, that story always comes to my mind, and it makes me want to reemphasize how important it is that we pray for our loved ones, that at least as far as we can tell from that story, that made a difference, if nothing else, in how Hiram and Joseph felt about things. And so I love the notion that there is power in prayer for our loved ones.
Yeah. Just kind of along those lines, there's a story, a similar story to that in my own family. My father-in-law was a fighter pilot during the Vietnam War, and on one occasion was flying over Vietnam, and he got shot down and was behind enemy lines for probably, I think, 3 or 4 hours before he was rescued and picked up. And he later found out that at the exact time that he had been shot down and was behind enemy lines, his parents were in the temple at that very moment and had put his name in the temple for the prayers of the temple to be had there. And, you know, I 100% believe that he was able to be rescued in part because of the prayers of his parents and their, you know, sacrifice their willingness to be in the temple at that time.
Yeah, that's a real deal. That's a great story. Yeah. And I it just means something. Prayer really does mean something. So,
yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. Great stories, great insights, great to understand this history a little bit more. And there really are some questions that surround this that have direct impact on our lives. Well, not because we're all going to march to Missouri, but because we get so much direction from God. And so often it doesn't go the way we thought it would. And so I'm so grateful that you've paid the price to learn about this, that you've paid the price to learn about how God works with us, and that you're willing to share it with us. So thank you for all of this and sharing all of this with us, Matt.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here. Really enjoyed the discussion.
Yeah, it's good for me. It blesses my soul. So, and I'm sure it does our audience as well. So we thank you all. We'd love to hear some comments or see some comments, read some comments. We won't hear them. In any of the forums, YouTube seems to be the one that's easiest for most people. But wherever you can read them, I have figured out how to see my Spotify comments now. So that's exciting. But anyway, we'd love to see comments on times where the Lord directed you and then it turned out to be different. I believe that if we have that online discussion, that some people will say some things that are exactly what someone else needs to read right now, what will make a difference in their life. So I hope that we will be willing to share some of that online, and that you're also willing to share some of this in person, whether, I mean, that could be a phone call, or let's say individually, whether that's a phone call or a text, or preferably in person, but whatever works for whomever you feel inspired to reach out to. We hope that everyone will do that. We also want to thank all those who support us and make the podcast possible, and those who are joining Patreon, and those who are part of our workshops and everything else. We just love this community and the chance that we all have to study together. It's a beautiful and wonderful thing. So thank you to all of our audience, and thank you, Matt.